on Life.
Hello, welcome to Lucas on Life. I'm Jeff Lucas. This is Premier Christian Radio. Let's talk about something that seems sadly increasingly relevant: conflict. In personal news, our son Richard recently qualified as an attorney, a solicitor, fulfilling a lifelong dream of his. He now works in a public defender's office in Florida, dealing with up to 50 cases at a time. He's had a real baptism of fire, suddenly plunged into the world of criminal justice. And so just recently I asked him what he'd learned so far from this brand new experience. His response was really challenging to me. He said, "Dad, there's so much anger, simmering, sometimes screaming rage that is so explosive." He told me that now he understands the odd phenomena of road rage, where people sometimes even kill each other because someone overtook someone at the wrong time. My conversation with my son about anger and conflict got me thinking, because there rather obviously seems to be so much anger and conflict in the world today. Back in 2024, it was recorded that conflicts are becoming more internationalized, with no less than 78 countries involved in conflicts beyond their borders. Perhaps we're in a place of conflict for a number of reasons. There's political polarization. People are less willing to listen to opposing viewpoints, and that escalates disagreements into shouting matches as each side seeks to assert dominance over the other. There's obviously economic inequality, with widening gaps between the rich and the poor, which leads to resentment and anger as people feel left behind. It's said that since the COVID-19 pandemic has contributed to declining civility, prolonged periods of social isolation have been linked to a coarsening of society and a rise in rude, aggressive behavior, something that's actually been tagged as pandemic edginess. And then just the high stress of modern life in a fast-paced, demanding world with a 24-hour news feed can stretch us thin emotionally, leading to a fight-or-flight response to even minor irritations. We also discover that there are plenty of people who agree with our point of view, as we can park ourselves in social media echo chambers. Algorithms and political news cycles create these echo chambers where we only hear from people whose views totally align with our own preferences and principles. And that can reinforce a kind of in-group bias and create negative feelings towards anybody who actually disagrees with us. I suppose the recent funeral of Charlie Kirk in America demonstrated the potential for conflict, even in such a sensitive and sad time, with some people celebrating the truth that the gospel was preached on that day, others desperately concerned that the whole event turned into something of a political rally. And so there's conflict now about the goodness, or maybe the damage, that it might have caused. So conflict, let's talk about it. Is it always a bad thing? And how should we Christians handle it? We're talking about conflict. Golfing has never been a favorite hobby of mine. It's not just because I'm rubbish at it. Mine is not a swing, more a spasm. And it's not that I think it's rather pointless to spend all day trying to use a stick to nudge a ball into a hole, or even more tiringly, 18 consecutive holes while avoiding sandpits. Most sports involve doing useless things expertly and in the shortest time possible. So that's not the reason for my loathing of golf. No, the roots of my disdain are to be found in my childhood. My trauma is superficial. My mother didn't run off in an electric cart with a chap who was wearing check trousers. Rather, my aversion is due to a rather painful collision between me and a golf ball. While camping with my family on the side of a golf course, I must get around to asking why we did that, I was walking between the golf tee and the green when the white cannonball struck. Now, I'm far too gentlemanly to specifically describe the area of my body that took the hit from the golf ball, But let me just say that the arrival of our first child was greeted with great joy and relief. It was a shot below the belt, literally. Talking about conflict, I've taken a few more direct hits since because I've been involved in church leadership for decades. Being passionate people, blessed with opinions, sometimes we Christians disagree and sometimes we squabble. Conflict and disagreement is inevitable and healthy. It's proof that we're not in a cult, which is good because I look horrible in orange. But we should disagree agreeably and commit to fight fairly. I've witnessed a few episodes of conflict that developed into something like a bare-knuckle cage fight, where the saints have gone marching in with hobnail boots. When we navigate conflict, we fight dirty when we make impossible demands that can never be met, as did the lady who insisted that our church wasn't loving enough, a charge that was difficult to evaluate because there's no measuring instrument available. And even if we did get a bad reading on the non-existent loveometer, what was I to do about it? I can hardly sprinkle Lucas's secret lovey-dovey dust over the congregation while they're not looking. And then another kidney punch is the accusation that the teaching just isn't deep enough. What exactly is deep preaching? Does deep mean that Tom Wright has been often quoted through the sermon, an ancient Mesopotamian tablet has been flashed up on PowerPoint, and the sermon has been sprinkled with a few Greek words other than kebab? Some Christians seem to think that deep teaching happens when they don't understand what on earth the speaker is talking about, as if their confusion is a sign that they are truly connecting with the transcendental. On the other hand, if a complicated idea is presented clearly, they're tempted to believe that the content is lightweight, and so the speaker is too. Thus, the better the teacher you are, the more likely you are to be accused of not being deep, because you're gifted to make the complex accessible. Another jab in the solar plexus is the statement, "Lots of people agree with me on this," jibe. "Everyone is leaving the church," said one permanently offended lady in our church, rather sniffily. I asked, "Who was evacuating?" "Loads of people," she said. "Who?" I asked. "Two or three are going," she insisted. "Their names?" I asked. "I am leaving this church," she said, as I resisted the temptation to headbutt my tambourine. But the knockout punch is thrown when we have a fight and we insist that God is the one who agrees with us. He's on our side, in our corner. When we thoughtlessly lob phrases around like, "God has told me," "God is with me on this," "God agrees with me," or bizarrely, "God likes the worship music that I like," we throw firebombs that usually turn a small conflicting spat into something like a world war. Before, we were having a rational discussion, but now, in disagreeing with our opinion, others are forced to imply that they don't think we've heard from God, and that we may well be self-deceived. And so dissenters become enemies, and calm conversation is rendered impossible. Sadly, too often leaders are the ones who resort to this form of warfare. So when it comes to conflict, if we have to fight, let's fight nicely. With that in mind, I'd like to suggest a new practice when the church starts to feel like a golf driving range. Sometimes we say amen when we agree, so why not yell four when someone drives an unfair and dangerous verbal shot? That way, everyone will know it's time to duck or quickly climb into a pair of armor-plated pants. Conflict. The gunman just stared at me, his eyes wide and an insane grin frozen on his face. 2 seconds earlier, a bullet from his rifle had whistled across the breakfast table where Kay and I and our 2 young children were sitting. Now, the room was clouded with the acrid cordite smoke that stains the air when a large bore weapon is fired inside a house. The bullet slammed into the ceiling above the table, showering us with plaster. We all immediately burst into tears, overwhelmed with shock and fear, our ears ringing from the deafening explosion. We looked around to see if our children were alive and still had all their limbs. They were unhurt, thankfully, but the gunman wasn't finished yet, because there was another bullet still to come. That day, well, it began so happily. We'd been invited to the home of a minister friend, an Englishman who'd relocated to Oregon. He loved every aspect of the backwoods rural culture: big hats, mammoth blueberry pancakes, and large guns. He'd bought himself a 308 rifle, a serious hunting gun that can kill huge animals and make mincemeat of humans. Eager to show off his dubious prize, he chose to demonstrate it while we enjoyed our bacon and eggs. Thinking that the barrel was empty and that the gun was safe, he cocked it and pulled the trigger. The bullet ricocheted off of a wood stove and whistled between our heads. The Reverend Assassin had ignored the most important truth about guns, and that is, always assume that they are loaded. Guns aren't as fashionable or available in the UK as they are in America. Personally, I say thank God for that. Yet, every one of us is in possession of a highly deadly weapon, which can create terrible conflict. The weapon? It's called the tongue. Scripture warns us about its firepower, variously described as being like a poisonous dart, a viper's bite, a forest fire, a sharpened razor, and a sword. And that's not an exhaustive list. The tongue can be an efficient little killing machine. With a so-called slip of the tongue, we can annihilate an innocent character with just one shot. Sarcasm can blast a soul's confidence. A well-aimed jibe or so-called clever put-down can take someone out. Marriages are slowly murdered by daily murmurs. And then there's the carnage that gossip creates. Strong churches have been scattered and too many vintage friendships shattered by the machine gun effect of gossip. Careless whisperers place loaded weapons in the hands of any number of people and then invite them to pull the trigger whenever they please and then pass the smoking gun on. Your turn, take a shot with sharing that gossip. Now, of course, the tongue can be a blessing too, because words can bring healing, comfort, inspiration. I love you is a phrase that has the sweetest sound. Stirring speeches can end wars and launch wonderful revolutions. Martin Luther King announced that he had a dream and oppressed multitudes were galvanized into action. And yet even those who try to use the tongue to help need to be cautious. To my horror, I've discovered that I can be quite quick on the draw as a gunfighter myself. You see, I spend a lot of my life using words, both written and spoken. That's what I'm doing here tonight on Premier Christian Radio. I love to craft a sentence, choose a phrase to communicate. But any gift that I might possibly have can also be used for evil as well as good. In conflict, I can be dangerous. Plucking a crucifying comment out of my armory, I can use words that sting and maim. Perhaps because the tongue is so dangerous, God placed it in a cage, and yet it still forms an escape committee. The medieval scholar Estius said of the tongue, though nature has hedged it in with a double barrier of the lips and teeth, it bursts from its barriers to assail and ruin men. So, if we're to avoid unhealthy conflict, when we speak, let's think first. And blunt though it sounds, if we're in doubt, let's just be quiet. Mark Twain was right. A closed mouth gathers no foot. Let's watch that tongue and always assume that it's loaded. Meanwhile, back in Oregon, our erstwhile gunman friend was not finished with his spree. Shamed and embarrassed by the fact that he'd very nearly killed his guests, he rushed into his bedroom, ejected the empty shell, and then, flustered, reloaded and fired the gun again, shooting a large hole in the carpet. His enraged wife threw him out of the house, insisting that he make the gun safe. He's since been allowed back in. But we don't have any breakfast plans with that family anytime soon. As we're thinking about conflict, let's realize that sometimes unhealthy conflict develops because, frankly, some of us live our lives just looking for trouble, eager to find fault and reasons for complaint everywhere we go. In telling a story that might feel reminiscent of Monty Python's Flying Circus, Jesus painted a portrait of a hapless chap who runs around with a magnifying glass, mustard keen, to identify specks of sawdust in the eyes of others, but all along oblivious to the whacking great plank that sticks out from his own head. Apparently, this log in Jesus' day would have been the main support for a house, which would have made it about 12 meters long, a significant protrusion. This farcical scene is frequently played out in times of conflict, especially in churches. Fault-finding souls, eager to catch people doing or believing something that is suspect, patrol around, searching for someone or something to correct. Sometimes they get together to form squadrons. When they find something that happens or appears to be amiss, they pounce on it with unseemly joy, thrilled by yet another opportunity to highlight a problem or see others fail. So, as I wrap up this evening's program, as we've been thinking about conflict, perhaps that story from the ministry of Jesus challenges some of us, and we're very aware that that has become our habit. We're looking for trouble, and when we do that, we'll normally find it. When conflict arises, and it will, let's handle it kindly, thoughtfully, biblically, and prayerfully. Thanks for joining me. See you next week.
Lucas on Life.